The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is December 31st, 2019. I'm Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Folks, look at that. I said three times. We won five. We've actually probably won seven.
Michael's been saying six.
Has he?
Yeah, he's been unsure, but saying six.
I mean, the five was the five-time best podcast award. Won a Webby best honorable mention, I guess, or something like that for hosting. Then the YouTube. We got the YouTube award. And then there was like two or three awards that I just sort of bankrolled myself and awarded to the show. Best Politics, Better Than Other Shows, and I can't remember the third one I called, but...
Did you have like a Black Star Award or something like that?
I did that for Who's the Caboose, actually. Okay. I had a film that was in the Aspen Comedy Festival over 20-some-odd years ago, 23 years ago, and I bought a... three-quarter page ad in Variety congratulating us on winning the Black Diamond Award, the prestigious Black Diamond Award. And there was, of course, no Black Diamond Award, prestigious or otherwise, but I got a lot of feedback from people congratulating me on that very award.
Sounds important.
It was prestigious. So, folks, you're listening to the very prestigious Majority Report, and I want to wish you a very dignified and prestigious Happy New Year. I don't know if you're aware of this, but tonight is New Year's Eve, and tomorrow will be 2020. So let this podcast today tide you over for the rest of the year, as it were. Who is it? It's Astra Taylor, author, documentary filmmaker, on her book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. A lot of people wrote us about including this one in the best of during our vacation, so you hopefully will enjoy. We also have a bunch of fun half stuff afterwards. We're giving it away free because we want to entice you to become members of the show. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com and sign up to become a member. It is your support that makes this show possible. And I want to just take this time. I mean, end of the year, I don't know why one would get sentimental, but I want to thank everybody who listens to this show, watches this show, emails this show, has become a member of the show, whatever it is. I can't thank you enough for giving me the opportunity, and I know everyone here feels the same way about having the opportunity to present to you what we think is important in terms of what you should know in terms of politics and for folks who are getting involved and trying to salvage this, you know, bit of a train wreck that we got going here in this country. And 2020 is going to be a big year in terms of the future of, frankly, not just the country, but, you know, the world. We're talking about climate change. We're talking about perhaps, hopefully changing U.S. foreign policy as it, you know, impacts the rest of the world, which is going through its own bit of a crisis in many respects. However, we really appreciate your support. We appreciate you telling your friends about the show and turning people onto the show, your parents, your kids, your cousins, your nephews, your nieces, your bosses, your employees, your coworkers, your... dog walkers, your dog walkies, whatever it is. So thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of this show. We got fun half stuff for you. Shout out to Brendan and Matt, and Michael and Jamie, David, who's been helping us out, and Dorsey and Lucy and Gary and Kelly and Jacob. If I missed anybody, and my sister Julie, who's helping us out, everybody who's contributed to the show this year by calling in or emailing or tweeting or Instagramming or Facebooking or Twitching or YouTubing, Oh my God, see you in 2020. Meanwhile, here's Astra Taylor. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program activist, author, documentary filmmaker. Latest film is What is Democracy? Out with Zeitgeist Films. And the book, the companion book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. Astra Taylor, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
This is low-hanging fruit in terms of a question, but I guess I have to ask, what is democracy?
Oh my God, you got me. No, I mean, what is democracy? It's interesting to flash back to when I first started filming the documentary and imagine myself being put in the position of the people I stopped on the street. You know, what would have been my answer then?
When did you start the shooting the documentary?
So I wrote the proposal for it all the way back in 2013 and got the green light and started filming in 2015. So, you know, I would say democracy is the rule of the people, the demos of democracy. The demos have kratos, which is, you know, power, to go back to the ancient Greek. And of course the Greeks didn't invent the process of democracy, but they gave us that word. And I think it's a powerful word, this idea that the people rule. I also like Aristotle's definition, which is democracy is ruled by the poor, because the poor are always more numerous than the rich, right? And so if we're talking about the majority making decisions, then it's not rich people, it's not oligarchy. So that's a nice way of just drawing a line between what democracy should be in the situation we have today.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience at Occupy, because I would imagine on some level the idea of this, if not necessarily inspired out of Occupy, but was at least informed in your experience there. Talk to us about that, because it seems to me that, well, I just start with that, and then I just want to talk about, you know, why Occupy happened when it happened.
Yeah, I mean, Occupy Wall Street, you know, so fall of 2011, it was a response to a movement around the world calling for real democracy. So, you know, it was inspired by the Arab Spring, and there was the movement of the squares in Europe and in places like Greece and Spain and well beyond. And so I got involved in the Occupy movement. In fact, I co-founded a union for debtors called the Debt Collective that is still active, and I recommend people check it out. The idea is to use debt as a form of economic leverage to change our financial system. But that, you know, Occupy was a movement that I think rightfully criticizing the status quo at that moment, right? The banks had gotten bailed out. The people had gotten sold out. The system we have is not democratic. It put the issue of class front and center, the 1% versus the 99%. So I think Occupy was a real game changer in many ways. And yet it was sort of in its DNA committed to a vision of democracy that was direct as opposed to representative. And this, in the beginning, was really beautiful because you'd have these mass general assemblies sort of at dusk, and, you know, people were using the human microphone, and it was very powerful. But it was not a functional mode of running the movement, let alone running the whole society. So I think what Occupy, you know, did for me was to go, okay, well, hold on, we're talking about democracy, but what do we mean? We know what we're against. We're against the concentration of wealth. We're against the exploitation of the environment. We're against the idea in Citizens United that, you know, money is speech. But what do we mean by the word? And I realized how little we had to fall back on in terms of basic political theory and philosophy. I mean, we, you know, most people had a kind of like middle school, high school operating, you know, level of understanding of sort of civics, right? And so it threw me back on this question, what do we mean by democracy? What do we want? That led me to make this film and to write the companion book.
We talk about it as being, you know, a democracy as being ruled by the people. Like, I mean, the my experience, I mean, I guess my sense of what was happening at Occupy at the time was that, you know, all of these type of these type of events, or, you know, not events, but just sort of like this phenomenon, have like a half-life. And on some level, that half-life, I think, was sped up, frankly, by Michael Bloomberg and maybe some, you know, coordination across the country of tactics. But be that as it may, part of the problem was, on some level, was sort of like, it was very difficult to deal. I mean, I remember going down there and having friends tell me, like, we're having real problem with this committee or that committee because it's being dominated by two or three people, which was ironic, right? That it's that democratic, but there ends up being people who sort of, I don't know, take more of the slice of democracy in that moment, you know, and it's just a different type of currency. Go ahead.
No, I like your phrase, the half-life. I mean, to me, I went down to Occupy, you know, in the first day and hung around those early weeks. And I thought, okay, this is going to burn itself out, right? This has a sort of inner clock that's going to reach its end. So I'm very surprised that we're talking about it today, you know, years after the fact. But there was something in that commitment to direct democracy and to democracy by consensus. There was a fatal flaw, which you just put your finger on, which is when you're operating by consensus, then a small number of people can veto. They have incredible veto power. And so what seems like it's going to be, you know, utopian and democratic actually turns into its opposite, because it becomes a sort of dictatorship of the grumpy few, or maybe people who are there to derail things purposefully. So, you know, what I took away from that, so the book is set up as an investigation into the contradictions or tensions that I think are at the heart of democracy. And, you know, so the entire book is very much attuned to the question of economics, the fact that we live in a situation with intense concentration of wealth and attention to the fact that capitalism is, I would say, inherently undemocratic in the sense that it concentrates wealth, it concentrates power, it concentrates ownership, right? So then how can you have people ruling themselves as equals? But with that, you know, so that's a sort of thread through the whole book, but each chapter is about a paradox. So one of them is the tension between consensus and conflict, right? Like, when do we aim for a total agreement in a group? Or when do we just say, okay, this is, our differences are irreconcilable and we're going to have to fight it out? There's not a one-size-fits-all answer for every situation. So the book looks at these things, these tensions that make democracy just really difficult to actually enact. So we can give a simple definition, democracy is the people rule, but how we actually do that requires a whole robust system of supports. It requires constant reevaluation and reassessment, and we have to hold these things in balance. Like, when do we aim to all agree and have a unanimous decision? And when do we just say, okay, that's not going to happen? We're going to have to use adversarial procedures to make it through.
Why do you think, I mean, the fact that Occupy happened at that time, right? That there was like it was certainly in the air. I mean, I remember, you know, just in 2010 trying to pitch people on the idea right now is sort of insider, outsider, like establishment, non-establishment, you know, that there was a sense of like so many people had been left out of even the supposed solution to this calamity, and mostly people who were responsible for it were able to sort of like, they were the first people to turn around and go, oh, I've got the fix for this. But it seemed like there was a lag time. What do you think accounts for that timing? And there was a lot of things happening in that fall. Was it that people were getting inspired by each other or what?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lag time. When I hear you say there was a lag time, I'm thinking there's a lag time in terms of responding to the financial crisis. I mean, I think we're still living in the aftermath of 2008-2009, and so for me, you know, Occupy was, on the one hand, it was like totally necessary in the sense that in those years immediately after the banking sector implodes, exactly as you say, the people there to put it back together again are the people responsible for it, and they're getting these massive bonuses. And then the folks agitating in the streets are the Tea Party, right? And that just was so ridiculous, egregious. And so, you know, people had been feeling the squeeze. They'd been feeling, you know, an economic pinch, right? We had been... we all know that since the 70s, you know, wages have stagnated. You know, we've been covering up for That stagnation with, you know, easy access to credit, so people were deeply indebted. And so I think on some level, it's like, okay, something like Occupy had to happen, but I think it needed that global context of all these other movements in order to sort of motivate people to take this step that seemed kind of ridiculous, which is like, okay, let's all go hang out in a park, which, you know, it's not a strategy that can transform the system, but was a strategy that got attention and I think did, you know, it's kind of a cliche to say it, but change the conversation. I think the question is, you know, what people need to do once that conversation has shifted, right? So that's sort of the problem of democracy that we're in now, which is how do you actually build power for the people? How do you transform democracy? And, you know, what I say in the introduction of the book is, you know, the challenge of the, you know, late 19th and 20th centuries were to, the challenge of democracy was extending the franchise, enfranchising all of these people, all these populations who had been excluded by formal democracy. I think the challenge for our time is extending democracy beyond that limited political sphere into other arenas of our lives, democratizing the economy above all. And, you know, that is a strategic challenge that, you know, something like Occupy was pointing towards the need for that, but didn't have the tactics or the strategy to actually do it.
Yeah. Do you think there, I mean, and then I want to move forward from this too, but,
yeah.
But, because I just, this, the whole phenomenon I think is interesting. Do you think that there is a set of strategy and tactics out there that, Occupy could have grown into or, you know, had adopted that would have had a different historical arc? I mean, I've asked myself this many, many times, particularly, mm-hmm. you know, or was that simply like that had to happen, it had to end, and then you have people like yourself who go out into the debt collective, but it also turned into sort of like, I think you could find a lot of people who are involved in Occupy in DSA groups around the country.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders, I think 2016 campaign doesn't happen if it was not for what Occupy injected into the bloodstream. I mean, I think there's a myriad of things like that where sort of the fallout creates all different types of movements, as it were. Or do you think there was like a set of strategies at one point that that could have been followed? That could have. I mean, the I think the committee on that gave feedback on the 21st century Glass-Steagall. People consider that document on what to do with the banks to be the most comprehensive and prepared document that came in, period, from anywhere.
Yeah.
How would you answer that question?
I basically agree with your summary of that it kind of had to go the way it did, because, you know, I think there were lots of us who were involved in Occupy essentially not because we totally agreed with its anarchist tactics, but because it was the thing addressing the economic crisis, right? So, you know, you don't get to just pull the perfect movement out of your purse, right? You have to go where the people are. I, you know, at the time wished there was a kind of speedier evolution, and I think there were these signs. The Occupy the SEC group who did the Volcker letter, I think that's what you're referring to. You know, other groups that were focused on foreclosures and home evictions, I thought those were really promising. But there was definitely a resistance to making demands of the state, to like collaborating with unions. And so I think there's a big shift right now, and you put your finger on it. The people who have gone into the Bernie campaign, who've gone into DSA, in a way, you know, the work we're doing with the Debt Collective, we're saying, okay, we have to make demands. We have to make demands of the state. We have to make demands of our financial institutions. You know, we have to not just be ungovernable, but actually to try to govern, to remake the machine that's running over all of us, right? To not only just be the resistance, right? But to try to be a real force in this world. And you know, it's a tough process because the left was so obliterated. I mean, that's why I was sympathetic to Occupy. There weren't organizations for, young people to join, to learn how to do the hard work of organizing. You know, unions are a weak in this country, right? So people don't have that tradition to fall back on. So I'm happy that, you know, we are that protest energy hasn't totally dissipated, and that it does seem like people are learning from the sort of problems of Occupy. And hopefully, you know, the thing is now we'll just have new problems to contend with, because they never go away.
All right. One last question about Occupy, just because I'm sort of fascinated. Like, when I think back in 2011, and we actually took the show down there, I think on the first Monday, maybe, which was after the weekend, and maybe it was raining, or maybe it was the first Friday, and we couldn't do it because it was raining. But we were back down there, and as far as I can tell, even then, which is only now 8 years ago, there was not a lot of talk necessarily. I mean, there was some talk of anarchists there a little bit, yep, but not hugely. And there was not even a lot of talk about like socialists, just in terms of socialism and how it has become an identifier that primary candidates in the Democratic primary 8 years later are like afraid of almost saying like, I'm not socialist. Like, you know, like that's a contentious thing to say now. What was your sense of that being there? I mean, and because I think you were there a lot more than I was during that time, just physically, but do you think that opened the door? I mean, I feel like that time was like a hinge, you know, and maybe it was a generational thing, or I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say two things on that, because I think it definitely did open the door. When I think back to the, you know, what could have happened sort of thought experiment of Occupy, to me, the failure isn't with the occupiers, who, again, were stepping into this void, right? Void of the left, and doing what they could. They had images of people protesting in the streets, so they protested in the streets, you know. To me, it was a failure of the establishment to recognize what was going on in that moment and respond to it with force and conviction, right? Because what you saw at Occupy was exactly what you just said, which is, you know, these people were not like diehard anarchists or necessarily always people with a sort of coherent left-wing ideology. They were people whose houses had been foreclosed on, you know, who were drowning in medical debt because some tragedy had befallen their family, who had gone to school like they'd been told to do their whole lives and are weighted down with unpayable student loans. I mean, this was a massive indication of the discontent that we're still dealing with today, right? So to me, I think, you know, the problem wasn't with the movement itself. It's the fact that the people with power just actually couldn't metabolize it, you know, and just wanted to continue to stick their heads in the sand. I think that I never would have guessed that democratic socialism would become words that were sayable in the mainstream the way that they are now. I think there were definitely individuals there who were, you know, identified as socialists or democratic socialists. I mean, you know, but what I think we could not have foreseen is that that would actually catch on. I think the Bernie campaign is absolutely part of that. I think the left can't take all the credit for the rise of socialism, because one thing is, you know, part of it is just the abject failure of capitalism to provide for people's basic needs, right? So, and so when you have a generation that is in debt for their education, that can't find stable employment, that doesn't think they're ever going to be able to retire, that sees a climate catastrophe on their horizon, they're going to start doubting the system that they've been told is the be-all and end-all of, you know, human capacity. So I think part of the credit goes to the failure of capitalism, and also to the fact that the right has branded just basic social services as socialism, right? So we're in a point where, you know, if Fox News is going to go around and say, you know, hey, being able to go to a doctor is socialism, then it starts to sound pretty good. Right. So I think all these factors are playing in, and I think the left actually needs to catch up and seize this moment. We can't actually take too much. We shouldn't take all the credit for it. It's like what there is there's sort of shift. There's an opening. We're still in that hinge moment, as you described it. And can we actually organize it? And this goes back to, know, this is part of why I was thinking through these issues in my book and my film, because I think this is a moment where, you know, in crises have always led to a kind of renaissance of thinking. And this happens all throughout political philosophy, where there's some sort of emergency or civil war or conflict, and new ideas come about. And we're kind of in that moment now, where because there was this massive financial crisis and the rise of the right, I think people are going, they're questioning things, they're questioning everything. And I think we need to nurture that questioning instead of going into an easy nostalgia, whether it's the nostalgia of the right, who wants to make America great again, or the nostalgia of the sort of centrist democratic establishment who just wants to make it 2015 again.
Moving, I guess, forward, at least through your book, to a certain extent, I'm sort of interested in this sort of, and you set up these different dynamics, like you said, the tension between, expertise and mass opinion. And you write about the anti-tax revolt in California, which ended up with Proposition 13. And then, you know, as a kid, I remember when this was adopted by Massachusetts, like 3 or 4 years later, and just 1 year went to school and half the stuff was gone. Like, there was no more sports teams. There was no more, art class. And in California in particular, there's been, you know, certainly through like the 80s and the 90s, there was this sort of, you know, populism, I guess, right? Like that, but it was not, I don't know if it was necessary. It was driven by non-democratic forces, it seems to me. But where do you get that sort of, like, talk a little bit about that tension between the sort of the expertise and the sort of mass opinion, which can be manipulable, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of those tensions, again, we can't resolve. I mean, one reason critics have always feared democracy, sort of elite critics, is that democracy, you know, there's no barrier to entry. It's not like you have to have a democracy degree and then you get to participate. So I think democracy does always have this risk, right, that people will get swept up, and the old idea of people having unruly passions and not being virtuous, and you know, that democracy will sort of self-destruct. I mean, Plato, in his famous text, The Republic, warns that democracy always devolves into tyranny. What I highlight in the film and the book is that he says that the conditions for that devolution are oligarchy, or the intense concentration of wealth. And what happens is, you know, the city splits in two, and it's the rich versus the poor. And that's what creates conditions for these plutocrats or these elites to create these sort of faux populist moments, right, that we're kind of living through now. So, I mean, I think we have to, what I'm trying to do with the question of the debate, the tension between experts and sort of mass opinion, is to say that we have to work to create a philosophical public, right? And the risk of that argument is that there's almost this, like, cliche idea that education is what will save us. Often if that's what I noticed going around with the film, when you'd say, okay, how can we fix democracy? People would say education. And I try to be a bit more critical in the text and say education for what, right? What is the curriculum people are being taught? Whose interests are being served? There's a very moving scene in the documentary, which I should say that people can stream. It's streaming on iTunes and Amazon and on Canopy, which is a service most libraries have. But where I interview these kids from an inner city school in Miami, they're like 12 or 13. And essentially you realize that what the curriculum that they're getting, the democratic curriculum they're being taught, is one of basically being told not to engage democratically. So they recount the story where they're asking for the school to heat up their food. They want their lunches to be warm, and they're just completely crushed by the teachers. And so, you know, this one kid says very movingly, like, yeah, they talk about democracy, but they talk about sort of like government. They don't talk about us actually being able to have a voice in the school, or us having power. So, you know, I think we need to sort of challenge the cliche that education is what will solve all of our problems. On the Prop 13 thing, I think you know, I write about that at length because it's such an interesting example of effective activism, and the left doesn't pay attention. I don't think we pay attention enough to right-wing movements. And I look at it because, you know, it began as a genuine revolt in California where people were having trouble paying their property taxes. And so some people on fixed income, older people who had bought their houses long ago, started to lose them. And what happened is this sort of charlatan guy was able to mobilize around that genuine problem and yoke it to a sort of anti-tax ideology. And then Ronald Reagan, who's, you know, would incorporate this into his run for president. And it was sort of a foundational conservative move and put anti-taxes actually on the national agenda. And why I admire the right as much as I disagree with their politics is that they understood that they shouldn't just refuse. They weren't just like, okay, we're going to refuse to pay our taxes. What they did was they remade the rules through a referendum, right? And they remade the modes of governing. And I think that's the step the left needs to look towards, to not just say, again, you know, resistance or we'll be ungovernable, or we'll put our bodies in the way of the gears of the machine, but how can we actually tackle those structures of power? How can we actually remake the system so that it's more equitable and more democratic? And so it's actually in the chapter that's on the distinction between spontaneity and structure. Like, yes, democracy needs the spontaneous revolts and these moments of protest, like Occupy or you know, where we're in the streets, but we also need to structure our system to make it have outcomes that we want.
But that's sort of a central dilemma, isn't it? I mean, because what happened with Prop 13 was also very similar to what happened was basically the Tea Party movement in many respects, right? Yeah. I mean, it starts with this sort of like notion of like, we're not going to bail out the homeowners because and sort of this energy that's out there, right? This maybe what is a legitimate anger is just subtly channeled. But the subtle channeling happens because there's someone with a tremendous amount of money who's basically like looking at this fertile, you know, piece of property and just sort of saying like, I'm going to seed over there and I'm going to seed over there. And then stuff grows there as opposed to where they don't seed with money. And there's no one on the left. There's not an analog on the left for that. Where, like, okay, we have all this energy. We're going to make it completely, you know, it's going to be decentralized, the decision-making on as the, you know, that structure. It seems to me that money, what it ends up doing is it creates a structure without imposing one, and it allows a sort of central authority to sort of create that without it make it seem like it is being created, because it's just a matter of like, oh, well, people are going to, you know, migrate to where the resources are. And that's where things are going to bloom, you know, the areas that are getting watered, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, both of those things, you know, those movements are definitely related, the tax revolts of the late 70s and 80s and the Tea Party. And it's true, like, you know, we can't dismiss both of them as totally just nothing but AstroTurf. There was a genuine, a genuine component. And then you're absolutely right. Institutionalized money, conservative think tanks and operatives were able to latch on and take those that discontent and harness it to their goals, which is to dismantle the state. And you know, they got a big return on investment, right? Because if you decimate taxes, that's money in your pocket. And so I think the left has more difficult conditions to grapple with on two fronts. One, we don't get that same return on investment, right? Because we're not companies just looking to lower our bills and get more money into our coffers. But I think we are trying to push the state to actually deliver social services. And so the right is just, you know, gets to be nihilistic because they just want the state to shrink down to, you know, to the point they can drown it in the bathtub, whereas we want the state to actually do good. So, you know, we have a tougher road. But I do think that something like the tax revolt's instructive because there could have been different solutions offered to those homeowners in need. For example, could it have been that if you were on a fixed income, you know, the law just said, okay, your property taxes actually your property taxes hold tight, but you know, a company's property taxes are going to go up, right? Instead of treating every entity like it's the same as the law currently does. Could we have started a conversation about why our homes, the places we live, have to be speculative investments that we hope will rise in value, right? So why, you know, that is part of the pathology of the American way, is that our house is our asset. I mean, and that led to the financial crisis of 2008, right? So why not talk about homes that are actually made for their use value to live in, as opposed to being an asset that appreciates, you know, so decommodifying housing, social housing. And, you know, so the left has to take some responsibility for not speaking to people's needs and not offering solutions that, you know, might have shifted the conversation. And this is why, you know, we have to get organized. We have to do that work because, you know, it's a cliche, but it's true. It's like, yeah, they have money, but we have people. And the right has always feared that since the beginning of democracy, and they still do, which is why they're always trying to sort of rejig the rules and mitigate the power of numbers. So, you know, we have to do the hard work of democracy. It's not an easy thing. And writing this book convinced me of that even more. It's a challenge.
So how close are we to it being gone? And what could potentially replace it?
Oh, replace the system we have.
Democracy, as it were.
Yeah. I mean,
it's you know, like a democracy on some level for us now is, you know, one part aspirational, you know, multiple parts sort of like difficult to pin down. But as you know, you know it when it's leaving, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's why I tried to get with the title, right? So the title of the book is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, to get to that sort of, to capture my own ambivalence, the fact that the system we live in is so far from what I believe a democracy is. And you know, lots of studies bear this out, right? That regular people have almost no say over the policies that right. govern us. And yet we know when it's being taken away. We know when things are moving backwards. I mean, just look at the news around abortion in the last few weeks. I mean, it's like devastating to witness. I think that I know we're in a state of emergency, and I've been talking about how we need to get organized, and I do as much organizing as I can through you know, my work with the Debt Collective and through being involved in electoral politics. But I also think we need to stop and think. Right. And to actually reflect on this word that we hear all around us that is invoked by people who are anything but democratic. And that's why, you know, I made the movie and wrote this book. It's like, what? Well, I think if we are going to have a chance of fighting for democracy, revitalizing it, evolving it, expanding it beyond the limited political sphere into these other areas of our lives, then we have to think about what the word means. What does democracy mean? And, you know, it's striking to me how few of us do that, how little time we devote to it, to this word that's everywhere. So that, I think, would be my sort of, you know, first challenge or hope for people, is to actually, you know, reflect on this concept and what do we want from it? Because that, if we don't do that, then we're not going to be able to sort of make progress and deepen and expand it and to I think, have a chance of getting us out of the mess we're in.
Astra Taylor, the book is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. And the film is What Is Democracy? Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to both of those at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
There has been, for a long time, we used to ask about the Bush administration, stupid or evil? And it's also possible at times where it's both. Now, like, let's take, for instance, like Ben Shapiro here. Ben Shapiro had this to say on his show. And this is one of those perfect examples of, like, does Ben Shapiro not, like, could he be, does he just simply lack the integrity? Or does he just talk without any awareness of what he's said in the past? Like, he just throw stuff off so carelessly and make these pronunciations because there's so much. He sticks his finger up in the wind, and the currents on the conservative side are so cohesive that you just got to do that quickly. You know which way the wind is blowing. You blurt it out. Boom. you move up a rung in their little social, metrics, and they get more funding. And that's why he does. And that's why he can't remember anything he said in the past. Or if he just has no integrity, and maybe I'm saying the same thing, like, because he has no integrity, he doesn't have to think about what he said in the past. None of it's relevant. And that's what allows him to do this. It really is a genuine mystery to me, but it's almost like on a daily basis that the further this guy goes in his career, the more he produces in terms of an output, the more he exposes himself as a total joke. This is a guy that they called the prince philosopher of the right.
The cool kids philosopher.
Yeah, whatever it is. I mean, like, honestly, this is how shallow their integrity and intellect is. Here is Ben Shapiro. And he could actually be a fairly smart guy, but I think that because he lacks such integrity, that there's no rigor. Here he is making what is not even, like, demonstrable is almost too weak of a word to say a demonstrable untruth.
It's like setting up an alley-oop where you pass the ball to the guy and then he dunks on you.
It's here is Ben Shapiro. Exactly.
Republicans impeached Bill Clinton in the 1990s. They never made a move to impeach Barack Obama, despite the myriad scandals that cropped up during his administration. I'm not aware of a single major Republican.
Pause it. Now, wait a second. I want to just go back and set the table here. He's talking about, like, the Trump derangement syndrome or something.
He was black, and they never impeached him for it.
Now, I don't know what the myriad of scandals were that he was talking about. Like, I really honestly don't. But just the myriad.
The myriad syndrome.
Understand, we're talking about a president in Donald Trump where he's 20, maybe more, White House officials have had to leave because of, like, inspector and general reports, because of criminal investigations. I mean, there's nothing even that remotely, you could go back and add up various two-time presidencies and not get anything even remotely close to this.
Trump derangement syndrome.
But that's
what you have.
But listen to where he's going with this, because this is really stunning. You know, I mean, like, we're talking, this is not ancient history he's commenting on now.
Barack Obama, despite the myriad scandals that cropped up during his administration. I'm not aware of a single major Republican figure who said that Barack Obama was not the legitimate president of the United States, despite the fact that Democrats have claimed that George W. Bush was illegitimate. They've claimed that Donald Trump is illegitimate. So this is just not true. And doubts about Barack Obama's belief system came from Barack Obama being an extraordinarily radical figure. Barack Obama said he wanted to fundamentally transform the nature of the country. That's a pretty radical statement.
All right. Well, let's put aside how radical of a president Barack Obama was. The idea that there was no, what did he say? There was no
major Republican figure
who questioned Obama's presidency. It wasn't until someone pointed out online, like, hey, you left out Donald Trump, who was one of the top birth certificate truthers in the country, if not the top birth certificate truther. And he's a Republican president now. And so Shapiro goes on to Twitter to defend this. Because, like I say, like, they don't have, they are blessed with a lack of integrity that also gives them a lack of, like, sort of examining anything that's going on. It's a very bizarre sort of trait that they have.
And then you can retreat into pedantry.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, wait a second. Do you use an apostrophe there? That doesn't count. But he goes on, he says, Trump was a fringe character for nearly the entirety of the Obama presidency. He wasn't a Republican figure, he puts it in quotes, until he ran. Now, I don't know what Republican...
You mean until he was aggressively sought?
I don't know what Republican figure, the word figure means, right? But that, this is the key. Like, I'm going to use words that could, like, that really are defined by me, right? Like, that are open until he ran. You can't name a single major elected Republican official during Obama's presidency who challenged the legitimacy of his presidency. Okay, so what Ben Shapiro has done, allow me to get a little bit Ben Shapiro-y, is he's postulated two assertions. One is that Donald Trump was a fringe character. He wasn't a Republican figure until he ran. Well, as you know, he ran in 2015. Here is Ben Shapiro tweeting in 2011. Why I back Donald Trump on the Ben Shapiro at big810am.com. Back in April 10th, 2011, Teacot Tea Party. That is a tweet of Ben Shapiro's talking about his radio show, why he backs Donald Trump in the 2012 presidency. Undeclared Donald Trump, who was not even a Republican figure. Now, by figure, I meant like someone who weighed over a certain, I don't know what the figure means, but he clearly was enough of a Republican figure that Ben Shapiro would dedicate an episode of his show to backing him. But maybe that's just a one-off. Oh, except for 2 days later, The Magic of Donald Trump, written by Ben Shapiro in Town Hall.
Maybe he thought he was going to run as an independent.
This is what's so funny, is that Ben Shapiro does not even have, like, his whole brand is built on the notion. I mean, first he's like part of this weird kid conservative thing, as like the Republican obsession with having like odd teenagers say their talking points. But he basically has a brand that's built on being a thinking person's conservative by like overwhelming college students,
right?
And
well,
public
no
forums
thought.
No, and no, but I'm saying, like,
let me finish here on this.
Breitbart, whole career at Breitbart,
of course,
before this.
It's absurd. In reality, the birth certificate is specifically geared towards certain political ends for Trump. This is him writing about first, it's obviously calculated to attract the most anti-Obama segment of the conservative base, indeed, and is already conceded if primary polling is any indicator. Second, it's designed to force Obama into defending his character. Trump has already suggested that, at his best, Obama refuses to come clean to the American people. Finally, it shows Obama that if Trump is nominated, the campaign will not be a McCain-style love fest. He's writing this in 2011. Understand. He's writing this in 2011. In promotion of Donald Trump to run against Barack Obama. In explaining why this works for Republicans. Is Donald Trump the best Republican candidate for president out there? It would be tough to argue otherwise, he writes. This guy claims he's not even a Republican figure until 2015. He's got all the makings of a breakout star. He's got bravado and the cash to back it up. If he really runs, he won't have any trouble finding supporters. As he puts it, the Obama administration's worst nightmare. Who can argue with him? Okay, so let's go back to the original tweet that that Ben Shapiro had, where he made two separate assertions. We have already established that assertion number one, Trump was a fringe character for nearly the entirety of the Obama presidency, was a lie. He wasn't a Republican figure until he ran. Well, of course, Ben Shapiro in 2011 certainly thought otherwise. But that, of course, was only 5 years earlier from the time that he ran. Then the second assertion that Ben Shapiro makes is that there is, you can't name a single major elected Republican official during Obama's presidency who challenged the legitimacy of his presidency. Well, let's go through it, shall we? Do you have those other tweets? Do you have the Mark Meadows video? Where Mark Meadows... And you know who Mark Meadows is, right? One of the top Republicans, the chair of the Freedom Caucus. Do you have the Mark Meadows stuff? We will pull that up right worth. There is a lot of folks, apparently, who were Republican leaders who questioned Donald Trump. Barack Obama's legitimacy as president. Let's start with Mark Meadows back in 2012. Do we have that video? Brendan? Was in that thread. Yep. Here it is. Sorry.
He's also moving the goalposts, right? To try to define Trump
you can't get
out
it?
Of being a Republican figure.
Hold on. I'm sorry. Say again?
He's also moving the goalposts to try to define Trump out of being a quote-unquote Republican figure when he defines it as a major elected Republican official, right? Like, you don't have to be an elected official to be a Republican figure.
There's absolutely no version of this where it's in that thread, the Ben Shapiro thread, right here. Scroll down. People came in and put it in there. Go ahead. Here's Mark Meadows.
So it seemed like this was settled. During the meeting. What are you learning now?
Yeah, Anderson, certainly some new scrutiny over things that Mark Meadows has said in the past. This is first and foremost something that he said 7 years ago back in 2012 about then President Barack Obama. It was something at the time that was quite controversial. It was reported on by many outlets, but certainly given that very emotional back and forth and high profile back and forth at the Cohen hearing today, it certainly is getting a fresh look today. Here's first what Mark Meadows said back in 2012.
What we're going to do is take back our country. 2012 is the time that we're going to send Mr. Obama home to Kenya or wherever it is. We're going to do it.
We also had multiple U.S. senators question Barack Obama's legitimacy as president. I'm trying to find this thing now. I can't find it in the goddamn notes. We had Shelby from Alabama, Mark Meadows. There were dozens of these people who had done it. So number two on his assertion is also wrong. Trump was a Republican figure. And there were plenty of elected Republicans who also failed.
Richard Shelby, who was a prominent U.S. senator, said in 2009, well, his father was Kenyan. He said he was born in Hawaii, but I haven't seen any birth certificate. You have to be born in America to be president, he told constituents. I think the senior Republican on the Intelligence Committee.
I mean, there were so many. Who else? There was others. I had that list. I don't know where it went. Where is it? Here we go. I can't see it. I don't know where you're sending me. Oh. All right. I can't get at it. I can't see where. Oh, here we go.
Jim
Mark Meadows,
Hoff.
Marsha Blackburn, Louis Gohmert, Brake Fahrenthold, Tom Coburn, James Inhofe, Jason Chaffetz, Sarah Palin, Michael Burgess, Alan West. Half those people ran for president as a Republican. So,
to be fair, none of them are as prominent Republican figures as Trump.
You know what my favorite thing is when you watch Ben Shapiro being fed his lunch to him. What he does after that is he starts tweeting maniacally about many other topics to bury this stuff as far as he can in his timeline. But the idea that, you know, like, yes, here is in Las Vegas where Mitt Romney accepts the endorsement from Donald Trump.
To happen to this country that we all love.
Pause it. Now, wait a second. I also want to just preface it with this. If you look in the corner of the television, there's three letters there. The letters are PBS. There are plenty of times where a politician goes around and gets endorsements from people that barely make the local news. But when Mitt Romney went to kiss the ring of this non-Republican figure, apparently, who Ben Shapiro wanted to be president in 2012, it made it onto PBS.
He's smart. He's sharp. He's not going to allow bad things to continue to happen to this country that we all love. So, Governor Romney, go out and get him. You can do it.
That was a nice hand pull there. Yeah, I noticed that too.
There are some things that you just can't imagine happening in your life. This is one of them.
being in Donald Trump's magnificent hotel and having his endorsement is a delight. I'm so honored and pleased to have his endorsement. And, of course, I'm looking for the endorsement of the people of Nevada. And,
yeah, there you go.
Got to praise the hotel.
Who is that guy? What is he doing there? You would think that it's such a part.
Isn't he part of the resistance in the Senate? Has anybody heard Mitt Romney's name mentioned anything? Right. The new
I was actually saying in the context of 2012, why would you have such a bizarre, obscure, non-Republican affiliated figure for such a major endorsement?
So Ben Shapiro takes it again on the chin. I can't wait for the next New York Times think piece on his. We'll get another profile of Ben Shapiro. Oh my God.
He's brilliant.
Speaking of people who are detached in some way from both reality and also in their pursuit of money or celebrity or attention or whatever it is, last night on Laura Ingraham's program, the Candace Owens, you remember she was the one who, what did she say about the Nazis? They were... You know, but for the
Hitler was too much of a globalist, basically.
Yeah, he was a little bit too.
He was
much.
Too Jewish. That's the primary critique.
Exactly, he was a little bit too. Well, she had some, but I think she said something specifically about like the Nazis. Like, if it wasn't for this,
if they were just trying to make Germany great, it would have been fine. But the problem is they went into Poland.
Right, right, right. Yeah, if they had just stuck domestically, right?
But it was a defense of nationalism,
right? So, and that, I think, probably led to her leaving Turning Points USA. I don't know if that was the case. I mean, there's a lot of questions.
So she went on with the Nazi.
That precipitated it. Yeah.
So here she is.
Don't go after the Jews too much for no reason.
Right, exactly. Here she is on Laura Ingraham's show. Now, this is a great catch. I first saw this from Maddie Hassan. I don't know where else did he, maybe where else did he?
Cody Johnson of Some More News was also tweeting about it.
All right. Well, so regardless, here is Laura Ingraham talking about to Candace Owens. And now it is the case that statistically, a lot of people became aware of certain racial dynamics in the country when Barack Obama was president. One is that they found out like that a black guy is allowed to be president in the United States. We know that 50% of white non-college educated voters found out for the first time that the Democratic Party was to the left of the Republican Party on race. Did you hear about that statistic? That was from Identity Crisis, that book. But according to Candace Owens, race was not an issue in this country until Barack Obama came along.
If the old way worked, I mean, I think there's wisdom to that. If Obama worked,
he's got to be talking about Obama.
I respect that. If the old way worked, who came before Trump?
Right. It was Obama, and Obama did a lot to tear this country apart. I do not remember when I was growing up having all of these race issues, okay? I really don't remember it. And then suddenly, towards the end of Obama, we started hearing all of this rhetoric drummed up. It became white versus black all over again. And I say all over again, I shouldn't even say that, because when I was alive, this was not an issue. It all became about race, and I really do think that they were laying down the groundwork for Hillary to run because they had already pre-selected her to be the president of the United States. So they started using that awful name-calling rhetoric, which they fell short of.
What did Obama do that drove
backed up
this
the police
discussion.
The police violence stuff? He backed up
the myth of police. Wrong,
it's the myth of police brutality.
Wrong,
I'm not done.
If they're wrong, he
added fire. Mm-hmm. He added gasoline to a fire that was simply untrue. The myth of police brutality as something that was a problem facing
the myth of
the
police.
Myth of police brutality.
Okay, we don't need to hear anymore. There's only so many mixed metaphors I can handle. There's nothing worse than folks to adding gasoline to an untrue fire. That is one of the most dangerous things you could do. Please do not try that at home. Now here's the thing. I just want, Nomi, I'm glad you're here because I'm not
Candace
so great
Owens
with...
Candace Owens expert.
I'm not so great with math. And she said, now, while she's alive, now she's still alive. At least she...
By appearance.
She appears to be. But she said by the end of Obama, can you give me the date of the end of Obama? At least in terms of the Obama presidency. When was that about?
January 20th, the morning of January 20th, 2017.
Okay, so the end of Obama could be like 2015, 2016,
sure.
2017. That's when, or maybe let's say 2014, we'll be generous to her. So we'll give a wide berth as to when Obama started to do this rhetoric or whatever. She also pronounces rhetoric weird. That's when the race thing started happening. Prior to that, in the entire time that she was alive, she wasn't even aware of race stuff, which is really weird because
she doesn't see color.
Yeah, she doesn't. She doesn't see color at all. Now, this is a clip from the Danbury, Connecticut News Times. Danbury, Connecticut, a little city in Connecticut, central Connecticut, more or less. Is that right? Near Hartford a little bit.
It's closer to New York.
Okay. And and here it is. This is January 23rd, 2008. The title of the news article is "A Racist Threats Case Filed by Stanford High Student Settled for $37,500. The lawsuit filed in May accused the city of, quote, failing to act in part because one of the callers is the son of Stanford Mayor Daniel Malloy. And this is apparently... Mayor Malloy, I guess. I don't know if he was the governor at that point. I don't know. The exact amount of the Board of Education paid the family of Candace Owens, now an 18-year-old Stanford High graduate, was made public yesterday after the advocate filed a Freedom of Information request last week. They spent an initial $25,000, and the school board has 30 days to pay the Owens family by check to their attorney, Norman Pattis. The entire $62,500 tab will come out of a $375,000 legal fund. It was a $25,000 cost to the city. So this is what happened. Last February, at least one of five teenagers sitting in a car left messages threatening to kill Owens, who is black, and repeatedly used a racial epithet. One of the three messages, one of them referred to her as dirty and threatened to burn her house down and tar and feather her. The group included Malloy's youngest son, Sam, sadly, then 14. The mayor released a statement in March saying his son cooperated with police, did not know the alleged ringleader, Evan Kopech, or Owens before the night of the calls. Kopech was a former friend and classmate of Owens. They had a shouting match during school. The Owens left school for 6 weeks, saying it was traumatic to attend with the alleged callers. She returned after Kopech was arrested in March, spring. The school system has done nothing to protect Miss Owens from repeated harassment, intimidation by the young men and her friends.
This is crazy.
And this, incidentally, the school officials suspended Kopech, but would not discipline him and other boys for incident committed off school grounds unless the police made an arrest, which drew criticism from the state National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
This is so crazy on so many levels.
And now, apparently, it's not, to be fair, it's not 100% clear from this story. Well, I guess they repeatedly used a racial epithet. Now, maybe she wasn't aware of race during this this time.
This was pre-Obama. By about a year. Memory just and put this in context. Malloy, right, who ended up being, I believe, the chair of the platform committee hearings of the DNC, became governor of Connecticut eventually from there in very quick time. I mean, that's probably when she learned to hate Democrats.
I mean, I don't know what led to Candace Owen from there until here. I mean, she stayed home from school for 6 weeks. She was clearly traumatized. And she's dealing with something.
Yeah.
And sadly, not dealing with it very well. And I have sympathy for that. But my edict is always, you know, I judge you if you're a public figure based upon what you put out in the public, and what she's putting out is pretty toxic and it's garbage. But it takes either a tremendous amount of emotional and intellectual dysfunction to do what she's done, or just a tremendous lack of integrity. And it's not conceivable that all things are not mm-hmm. in play in that.
She's also making a lot of money.
There you go.
It kind of reminds me of Juanita Broderick, right? Because she was legitimately traumatized by Democrats, including Bill Clinton, namely. And I can totally understand why she hates the Clintons and hates the Democrats. I don't understand why she would then decide that Trump is good. But, like, sometimes the enemy of your enemy is your friend.
Well, and that's ultimately, I think, this weird space that we live in.
But let's be clear on one thing. When a child is 14 years old and participates with these other guys, to blame that on the Democratic Party is, that doesn't make quite as much sense. I mean, it's one thing where I mean, I understand.
He's the mayor. I mean, like, he's powerful. Suddenly they don't deal with, you know, his son doesn't have to deal with the consequences. It's a Democratic mayor. All the Democrats are corrupt. But, you know, you go through these. And if that's her evolving brain and maybe her parents.
If she had said Democrats usually are the ones who are attacking black people, that would at least make more sense. But to say that race was not an issue until Obama. Right. A little dubious.
Well, she's doing the work for them now. Like, she's a partisan soldier, and she's going to say whatever she needs to say to help them.
And help her.
Help
get,
her.
Go viral.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Like, I think she really believes in this stuff, and she is making a ton of money off
I don't
of
believe
it.
That she believes in this stuff, just like every other person I've ever met on Fox News doesn't actually believe this stuff unless they're Nazis. Like, I really, truly think most of the people that I've met on Fox News, especially young, it is an act. Like, you get off, I'm sure you've debated these people, you get off set and you can have a normal conversation. It's the Democrats that you fight with that I can't even, we walk off and we're not talking to each other.
Right.
Oh, I don't
right.
mean that she literally believes in the stuff she says, like, oh, race was never an issue before right. Obama, but I think she really believes in the Republican side and she's going to say whatever crazy nonsense she has to say to help them, no?
No, don't believe it. 100%, don't believe it.
I think she just probably thinks that politics are irrelevant.
Yeah.
And that's the way that you just can enter into this. I mean, I remember talking to... I think it was Larry Elder in the 2004 DNC. And Jeanine Garofalo and I were there. We had been doing this for four or five months, maybe. We took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. And he said something to us to the effect of, like, you know, we were, come on, guys, game day. You know, we're not on air now. We can just talk. And I'm like, what? Like, you just take this, like, this is all a game to you?
Well, it's money for them. I mean, remember that guy, Boris?
Epstein?
Epstein, okay. So,
are you kidding?
I got to know him very well in 2016.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He's, like, part of the investigation now, and now he's on, what's that?
He's on Sinclair.
Sinclair, yeah.
We play him all the time.
He wanted to host a show on Sirius with me. So I got to know him very well. We would have lunches before I realized it was like a right-left thing. And also at a time when we didn't think Trump was going to win. He was deep, but he wasn't. It was unveiled that he was much deeper than I had even imagined. But he was so pleasant, despite the fact that he would yell at makeup artists, to me as a human being. And what I really realized very quickly in our conversations, as we were discussing, you know, a right-left show, which everybody wanted at that moment, was he just wanted to make money. And every single conversation would come from this place of, this is how we're going to make money. This is how, you know, we can monetize this. My brain just doesn't work that way. Sorry to, like, it doesn't formulate that way. And so the communication barriers between us were, he's taking this role and I'm taking this role. And he would be like, well, you know, you can always evolve on this. If Hillary becomes, you know, the nominee, you can support Hillary. And I'm like, no. And, you know, it was just, he didn't understand that it wasn't flexible for me.
Right. Right.
I think
on some level that is why there's a certain advantage that the right has is that they have no shame and no integrity, which allows you to a lot of flexibility in terms of, like, you know, shifting in certain directions so that you can
support a coup,
keep your voice and support a coup. So
that's it.
Really?
I mean, this is one reason why it's been so hard to understand fascism historically, is that malleability on the part of the right and that rhetoric slippage and the irony, non-irony, like, continuum that it exists on. It can be whatever it needs to be at any given point in time. Whereas people on the left have, you know, an ideology.
It is much easier to be sort of like somewhat detached and flexible with your racism and your hatred of others. You can always just sort of like make an exception here and there.
Can I ask you just a quick question?
Of
course. In terms of exercise. So there's not a lot of places on the left where we can have conversations about issues. Definitely not in cable news. You're very rarely invited on at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And Fox and the right wing, you know, you are often given a space to be a little bit more open with your beliefs. And if you choose to use that, like take a clip from Fox News and make it go viral or make fun of, you know, the right wing or whatever it is, you know, you can use it to your advantage, but they're using you. I mean, where's the line there? Like Candace Owens is using media for her career and shifting her beliefs. But when the left goes on the right, this is a real, what is the line? Like, because there's no space, this is because we're talking about Juanita Broderick, and I'm thinking, how do you get
to
that point?
So you're saying when you go on to Fox, are you helping Fox more than are you helping Fox because in some ways it also promotes yourself versus like sort of, I don't know, waging a good fight? Is that the question?
Sort of, but also it's a slippery slope. Like, so... You know, I believe that, you know, there are plenty of people in America who've not been spoken to by the left, and Fox has a monopoly on much of America. And so you need to get that message out there, a populist message, even if you have to creep it in. But there are many people who think that, like, just don't go on.
Right.
Because they're making money off of you, and maybe they don't understand the complexities of Fox, but, like, ultimately they're making money off of you. Also true. But then you look at someone like Juanita Broderick, who no one in the mainstream media would cover. And many others, like even the Jeffrey Epstein story, right? Nobody would cover this. They would hide it. And the only space you can go on to release that is maybe right-wing media. And that is how someone like Juanita Broderick, who's not a political professional, can maybe go slide into Donald Trump is the person who finally gave my story the space that it needs.
Right. I'm not sure I know exactly what you're asking.
I'm just saying, like there are people like Juanita, there are plenty of people who aren't able to get their stories out, and so they use the right wing. And I don't know what Candace Owens, you know, how she ended up sliding that way, but is that bad? Is that a bad thing for people to use a Fox News or a, what's the thing where the Epstein thing was?
Well, I mean,
ABC,
you know,
one?
I don't know that Juanita Broderick is doing anything. I don't think what she's doing is a political exercise in her mind. I think what she's doing is, you know, she is seeking some semblance of her own personal justice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess arguably, you know, some broader sense of justice. But I mean, I'm not in a position to make that assessment, but I don't think she's operating on a completely different sort of set of ground rules than, let's say, someone like you or I, or like a political candidate.
Well, what about the woman who leaked, or we don't know who it is actually, that leaked the Epstein things to Project Veritas? Project Veritas is disgusting. It's a disgusting outlet, if we want to call it that. You know, most of what they publish is crap and set up.
It doesn't reflect well on mainstream corporate media that people are feeling the need to go to the right.
Well, I suspect that the person from CBS who got fired, right, that had worked at ABC, mm-hmm. I suspect that they are just right wing, and they saw this as a right, you know, as a political, they saw it as political, like. I think had they gone to a different outlet.
Yeah, they could have gone to TrueAnon.
Or they could have gone to, like, The Intercept.
Right.
Yeah. And it would have gotten, I think, a lot more coverage, frankly. I just think that was a mistake that was, you know, someone was blinded by their own ideology, mm-hmm. and saw this in the context of an ideological thing where it wasn't, I don't think it was ideological. I think it was, you know, there are outlets that are not sort of like mainstream corporate establishment outlets that are far more, I think, sort of legitimate from my perspective than Project Veritas.
Right.
I think, and I think that's a broadly shared assessment, you know. And so, but I, you know, I think in the political realm, you've got to, it's, it's a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. I think there are some people who should never go on Fox because they're going to get rolled. Mm-hmm. I think there are other people who, like, can go on Fox and maybe do a one-off. Like, you know, your buddy...
Rutger Bregman.
Rutger Bregman. I thought that is, you know, he was basically like, I'm taking a flyer. I'm going to do one. And
arsonist.
Arsonist. And I think that's very effective. You know, so I think it... You have to have a proper assessment of what you're going to bring to the moment. And
also just, I mean, when you do go to the far right and you make an argument, there's a careful balance. It might be a very legitimate argument, but it can be completely ignored or dismissed by centrists because you're going on that platform. And I think that's the game that they have is, oh, don't pay attention to Project Veritas in that clip because it's Project Veritas.
Right. Well, I mean, frankly, it's like, I mean, we ran with that clip. But it is, first off, Project Veritas is not a reliable source.
Right.
And so we got to make sure that that clip is real and exactly. We would scrutinize it a lot more than we would have had The Intercept put it out. Because I trust, you know, when the editors of The Intercept get that type of material, I trust that they're going to vet it.
Right.
I mean, just they have a track record of you know, being an actual journalistic enterprise, mm-hmm. whereas Project Veritas has a track record of being
going to jail.
And being a myth
literally.
Maker. So, I mean, that, you know, that's the thing is all this is sort of very, it has to be very contextualized, I think, in any specific moment.
That to just to make you aware about the situation that you are in, sir. So that is in some outstanding taxability spending under your name. So let me introduce myself. I'm the senior investigation officer, and my name is Matthew Benjamin. My batch ID number is AR101095. So could you help me out the first name and last name so that I can pull up your address from my system?
Yes, absolutely. That's John,
J-O-N,
Benjamin.
Yeah, yep. Benjamin.
Yep.
Okay, could you help me with the shipping address?
The shipping address?
Yeah,
okay.
Billing, present billing address.
Yeah, it's P.O. Box 1004.
P.O. Box.
P.O. Box 1004.
Okay.
And that's in...
1004.
Yes. In.
Okay, go ahead.
Hudson, New York.
In Hudson, New York.
Yes. 12534. That's the address I file for my taxes.
Just hold on.
Hello?
Just hold on.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I apologize.
Okay, I will repeat your billing address, P.O. Box 1004 in Hudson. After that, what you said, could you please repeat for me once again?
It is in Hudson, New York, and the zip code is...
What you said, zip code?
Zip code is 12534.
12534.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you for your patience, Mr. John Benjamin.
Thank you.
And the reason which I've called you that it's in some outstanding tax pending under your name, so which you are being listed as in a primary suspect. So I'm talking about your federal taxes, John.
Right.
So which you pay every year, either incorrect or else you have made some mistakes while filling the taxes.
Right.
So please grab a pen and paper handy with you so that I can say the case ID number, brief information about your case file.
Okay.
Your case ID number is C as in a Charlie,
C
as in a Peter.
I'm CP90. I'm sorry, CP.
CP.
Yeah.
90.
832. Of course.
Okay. This is the case ID number which I also have the legal affidavit against you, which is been
can
issued
I just
by
say
the Internal Revenue.
The part of the problem is.
Yeah.
Okay, so I, as you probably know, I am the voice on some major cartoons, and I recently switched my accountant, and of course, I'm quite convinced this guy...
Wait a minute.
He probably didn't know what he was doing. Oh, God.
Just hold on. I will transfer my call to my senior investigation officer. He will handle the further details for you. Just hold on.
Okay.
Yes, thank you for holding the line. Your call has been transferred to one of the senior supervisors. You are speaking with Officer William Hull with the badge number 171063. I believe I'm talking to you, Mr. John Benjamin, right?
Yes, yes, you are.
Now, Mr. Benjamin,
yes.
My junior officer must have explained to you about the payment, what you owe to the IRS,
no,
about your case.
I'm sorry, he didn't say a number. Let me just say, in my own defense, this was clearly a function of a new accountant that I have, and I'm going to fire him immediately.
I understand. See, okay. Mr. Benjamin, this point of time, I believe he had explained to you about your case, the lawsuit which has been filed against you, and about your arrest warrant. Am I correct?
Oh, no, he did not. I had no idea there was an arrest warrant. I obviously... Look, I'm a voice on some major cartoons. I can't possibly be arrested. What can I do to get out of this?
See, Mr. Benjamin, exactly the reason why we are getting arrested, why you are getting arrested, is because the reason why you are getting arrested is because when IRS always filed a lawsuit against U.S. citizens, they even applied for CP-503 notice. That CP... 503 notice is an investigation arrest warrant. Understand?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that I philosophically believe that income taxes are theft. I don't even subscribe to the notion that you have the right to tax me. But I understand if I'm... I understand I have to comport to your laws.
Right. So the total amount, what you owe to the IRS, is $5,786.
Well, that, for me, is virtually nothing. I mean, I'm extremely successful.
All right.
Yeah.
I understand, Mr. Benjamin.
Right.
See, today itself, if IRS gave you a chance to resolve this case, would you be able to come up with this total amount today itself?
Today? Do you need it today?
Yes. Right.
Well, of course. Cash? Would cash be okay?
If you have a cash, we have no problem. But you have to make
how
sure there are certain conditions.
How would I get this to you? How would I get you the money?
Mr. Benjamin, you aren't going to send this money to me. You're going to pay this amount to the IRS at the IRS official website.
Okay.
All right. What's the website? Let me explain about the payment procedure that you have to follow.
Let me just be clear, Let me just be clear. This will get the charges dropped if I pay the money.
Exactly.
Okay.
Once the payment will be getting accepted by the IRS, that point of time, what the four charges has been pressed against you, that charges will be dropped down immediately.
Okay.
Do you know what a PDF files are?
A PDF?
PDF copies.
A PDF file?
Yes.
Is this something I committed?
PDF files, which you can download as a soft copy from the internet.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes.
So, what you have to do, once you make this payment to the IRS, there will be three pages. One, the cancellation, mistakes, what you have done under your tax paper. One will be that PDF file. Second will be the cancellation arrest warrant. Third will be the receipt.
Of course.
Are you clear?
Yes, I understand. Now, the specific charges, this does not involve anything that happened with the vehicle that I had borrowed from my uncle. That has nothing to do with that.
No, that's nothing to do with
that. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that, because he was claiming that he was going to press charges, but he would not have done that with the IRS.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Benjamin,
yes.
In order to get this case resolved, there are certain conditions and there are certain protocols that you need to follow. The reason because IRS never accept payment over the phone call.
Right, of course
what
not.
What you have to do is you have to physically do this payment on your own. But as you have no idea what this payment can be done and how this payment can be done,
right.
I will explain you how you can do this payment.
Okay.
But while you're doing the procedure, I need to record everything, whatever is going on between you and the IRS.
I see.
So we can have an idea. This recording will be played inside the courthouse that we can show them. We told you about the payment procedure and you had followed.
Now hold
that.
On. You're going to be recording me?
These lines have been getting recorded.
Oh, gosh.
You're talking with me on a federally monitored and recorded phone call.
I just have to say, right now, I am I'm an acclaimed voice artist. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with some of my work. Have you ever seen Archer?
What is it?
Well, it's on FX. It's a very popular show. Archer.
So what is it?
It's a cartoon.
Okay.
And Bob's Burgers.
Uh-huh.
That's on Fox.
Right.
Now, of course, the man who plays Hugo is more or less the lead of the show, but I support him in many ways.
It's getting, you're talking me, you're talking about something that it is out of this case. All right.
Oh, no, I'm just simply saying I'm a voice artist. If you're recording it, as long as it's not used for publication, because I am a member of a union and I have contracts and I don't want to violate those contracts.
Hold on. Now,
yes.
Mr. Benjamin, I'm going to transfer your phone call to the extension of my senior authority, and he will be talking to you. He will guide you what the further payment procedure will be, and he will even tell you what the certain protocol and procedure that you need to follow.
Okay.
All right?
Yes, all right. And who, I'm sorry, whom I will you be, hello? Hello? Who will you be transferring, hello? Ugh.
All right, you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
All right. Now, sir, my name is Officer Alex Anderson. I'm the Senior Investigation Officer working down on your case file.
Alex Anderson?
With the Attorney General in order to stop your arrest warrant and resolve your case. All right?
So the Attorney General is involved in this?
Yes, sir.
Oh, God.
So this call is federally monitored and recorded by the IRS, local police authorities, Attorney General's office, as well as the federal courthouse.
Okay.
Now, sir, do you know what is the outstanding tax amount that you owe to the IRS?
Somewhere in the thousands of dollars, I believe.
The outstanding tax amount that you owe to the IRS, which is $5,786. So if I give you a chance in order to stop your arrest warrant and resolve your case, would you be able to come up with the outstanding tax amount that you owe to the IRS today itself? Do you have this much money with you or in your bank account?
Of course. Of course I do. I spoke to earlier to the gentleman I just spoke to. My issue is, listen, I am a fairly prominent, I mean, some would say extremely prominent, voice actor. And so I'm concerned about the recording of my voice.
Well, this whole recording and this whole conversation is the only evidence you have as a proof of your settlement.
Okay. All right. Well, then...
Which is going to be going in your favor.
Okay. Well, if it works in my favor, what do I need to do?
This is the only evidence you have as a proof of your settlement. This whole recording and this whole conversation is the only evidence you have as a proof of your settlement.
Should I be getting a lawyer? How long in prison?
I'm going to be guiding you, sir. I'm going to be guiding you. I'm going to be telling you how we're going to be working out things. Now, where exactly you are, sir? You're at your work or you're at your home?
Excuse me?
Where exactly you are? You are at your work or you are at your home?
Oh, well, I'm at work, of course. I mean, I'm in my office.
All right. So you need to leave from your office. What I want you to do is I want you to grab a pen and paper with you, your driver's license, your debit card or credit card, whichever you're going to be using.
Of course.
And I want you to leave from your office and I want you to get in your car. Now, once you get in your car, I'm going to be forwarding this recording to the Attorney General's office so they can work on your case file, all right, in order to stop your arrest warrant. I'm going to be guiding you the further instructions, the protocols and the conditions which you're going to be following in order to stop your arrest warrant.
Okay, wait. I don't have a car. am I? What if I can get a bike?
No problem, sir. That will do.
Okay. So I don't have to go far.
No, you need to leave from your office first.
Okay.
And I want you to go near to your bike. No. I will tell you what you got to be doing.
Now, wait a second. How will you be able to talk to me if I'm not in my office?
I believe I'm speaking to you on your cell phone.
No. No, you're not.
This is your office phone.
Well, I called my office phone because I got the phone call from the Attorney General mobile phone, and I get very poor reception here. I'm very concerned.
What is your mobile number?
Oh, God. It is 917-555-5555.
Is that your mobile number?
What's that? Oh, no. My mobile number. Oh, I'm sorry. It's 917-555-4000.
Are you sure this is your cell phone number?
Let me just double check. Oh, yeah. This is... you can understand why I'm very disoriented right now. Is there any way that I could just do this online? To leave the work right now would be a problem for me. I have things to do very shortly.
All right. Now, you tell me, sir, which card you're going to be using. Either it's going to be your debit card or credit card?
I can use either. Which is better?
All right. You can use any of the cards, sir. Could you please help me out with your card information?
Of course.
All right.
Do you need my social security number to make sure that I'm credited on my account?
No, it is not necessary, sir, okay. Because this call is federally monitored and recorded, sir.
Of course. So
could you please help me out with your number?
Yes. Do you take American Express Platinum?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well. Do you want the number now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. 3 7 3 6 4 4 1 3 8 1 1 9 5 0 3. Hello?
That's all?
You wanted the credit card number, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Would you read it back to me?
Could you please read it back to me, sir?
Will you read it back to me?
No, I did not make a note, so can you please read me the numbers one more time?
Wait, did you get the numbers?
No, I did not.
Okay, do you want to read that back to me?
I want you to read it back, sir, because I don't have the numbers.
You didn't get the numbers?
No. No.
Hello?
No, I did not, sir.
Okay, do you want to read that back to me?
Yeah, I want you to read it back, yeah.
Okay, would you read that back to me?
I don't have the numbers, sir. I want you to read that back to me.
Hello? Did you get the numbers?
No.
Okay, would you read that back to me, please?
I did not get the number.
Hello? Okay. Did you get my... Is that credit card okay?
I want you to read me the card numbers one more time.
Yes, I just did. Would you read them back to me?
I want you to read it back one more time.
Okay. Do you want a different credit card?
Yeah.
Oh, a different... Okay. I will get you a different card. Is that card doesn't...
Okay.
Because I've had problems with that card.
All right.
Okay. Do you accept MasterCard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is not... There's no color associated with it. Okay. The number. 4-1... 5-1-1-9-9-4-5-1-3-4-5-5-5-6. Do you want to read that back to me?
Just give me a moment.
Did you get it?
Sir, are you trying to fool around?
No, sir.
Because this card is not valid.
What are you talking about? That card is valid. I have it right here in my hand. Will you read back the number? I don't think you're taking the number right. Hello? 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 Can I go back to the other person? Hello? Hello? Oh, rude man. Well, this is part of the problem with the American government. I mean, clearly, the enforcement actions of the IRS are not very good. God. Alex Anderson. shit.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught.